Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6 p.m. to explore questions, large and small, whatever piques my curiosity or perhaps yours, dear listener. The question today is about addiction and recovering from addiction. And I am honored to have with me two gentlemen who are in the 12-step recovery program, and they call themselves Two Guys Recovering and Finding Peace. They are Toph. Welcome, Toph.
Thank you.
And Lucas. Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you.
Thank you both for joining me. You know, addiction is one of those topics we talk about in the shadows. In the shadows of our families, in the shadows of our culture. And when we spoke before we went on the air, you guys told me that the notion and the addressing of addiction has changed or evolved over the years. Can you tell me how, where it started in our, say, modern culture and where it is now?
Yes, I'll field this one first.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, let's just take it back even a step farther than that. At first, it was considered a moral weakness addiction. So we looked at this in our society for thousands of years. We considered addiction, alcoholism, a moral weakness.
Thousands of years. Wow.
Anybody suffering from this stuff, we considered morally weak, and they needed religion to fix that.
Ooh.
So that was how we viewed it historically. Over time, enough people had gotten sick and things weren't working as far as a real solution to things. And science came to be, and we have a medical lens to look at addiction now. This physiological response to mind-altering substances, it affects the brain, the nervous system, and addicts and alcoholics just respond differently to mind-altering substances. So that's the medical lens. That's the current way we're looking at it. Society is still catching up with that. And there's also one last one, the trauma lens, about how addiction it stems from trauma in childhood and how it's a coping mechanism that we use. So those are the three lenses that are most often used with addiction.
So with the medical and perhaps even the trauma lens, are we looking at a particular brain chemistry that is more vulnerable to addiction?
Absolutely.
Lucas?
Well, I'm not sure which lens is applicable to my situation, but I started off me just really enjoying getting high, and I liked how it felt, you know, and I came from a loving upbringing. I don't think there was any real reason why I became a drug addict other than just absolute adoration for the way it made me feel. And then, of course, after time, it just spirals down, you know?
Absolute adoration for the way it made you feel. What drew you to the first experience, and how did you get it, and what was it?
Smoking pot and stuff and drinking beer is pretty fun, you know, but I remember these guys that are hanging out with, they were smoking crack, and I was, I think I was 17, and they wouldn't give me any because they said I was too young. And finally, I convinced them to just let me try it, and it was wild. It was the best feeling I've ever felt. It was like we talked about earlier. It was it was like the feeling of being in love and being loved back. It was just love. It was a euphoric, warm, loving feeling. Yeah, it makes, I don't know, it being intoxicated kind of just made me feel like it's okay to be me, and other people seem to like me when they're intoxicated. And I tend to, it just all starts as a good time, you know, and when the party's over and reality sets back in, that's not a comfortable feeling. So you want to keep the party going, you know?
And so the two of you are in recovery now. And Toph, you are an addiction recovery counselor.
That's
is that
right.
The appropriate
Somehow
term?
Somehow I ended up as an addiction recovery counselor.
Well, you got experience.
To my friends that are listening, I know you never thought I would ever do it. Here it is. I didn't either. Years later.
Well, you gave me a perfect outline for our conversation today, and that was how it was or what it was like, what happened, and what is it like now. And so, Lucas, you kind of started the what was it like conversation.
Yeah, well, one of the main traumatic experiences where I've really felt absolute loss of control, that little story. And it didn't always start that way. I mean, like I said before, I came from a loving upbringing and I was a good kid and we had a nice house and all that good stuff. And along the road of doing drugs, it kind of led me into the harder stuff and then injecting it.
Injecting what?
Methamphetamines, cocaine, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so lost our house. I lost everything, staying in hotels, you know, and then finally absolutely nowhere to go. And we were, when I say we, it was the girl that I was with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, then it stemmed into, seeking shelter at these 24-hour laundromats. And, one time we were walking, it was in Portland. I think it was February. It was freezing cold and a little pickup, like a little Nissan pickup, pulled up next to us. And these two kind of creepy guys said, "You guys don't have anywhere to go, do you?" It's like they knew. It was weird. And
that is weird.
And I said, "No, we don't." And they were like, "Well, you guys can come with us." And I didn't want to. We didn't want to. We didn't know who these people were, but we didn't have anywhere to go. For some reason, we said, okay. There was no room in the front because it was one of those little tiny mini pickups, you know, like a Chevy Love or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they said she got in and she sat in the middle of them, these two guys. And then they told me to get in the back. Well, the back was completely filled with garbage, just rubbish and garbage, like trash bags. And it was, so I crawled in the back and then they said I had to get down because they didn't want to get pulled over. And, we started going and it was freezing. So I'm kind of snuggling and buried in this garbage. And I was laying on my back and I remember looking up, trying to figure out where we were at the street lights. And we'd pull up to an intersection and turn. And I just watched these street lights go by and I had no idea where we were going. I had no idea who these people were. And at that point it was like, I am completely out of control. I have no control over what's happening right now. And this is kind of the path it's going down.
Were you afraid?
Yeah, I was not necessarily afraid, sad. It was sad.
That you had lost control.
Yeah, well, it was just, I remember watching her get high and crying. Like, this is, we're just
lost. Toph, what was it like for you?
Same thing. Absolute same.
Out of control.
Different details, same exact thing. I love what Lucas said, the absolute adoration of how it made me feel. In the beginning, it started for me, it was in my family, alcoholism. Mm. It was in my community. And it was something that made me feel okay. It was an electric feeling in the beginning. And all through the course of the progression of my disease, I mean, I loved that feeling of getting high and getting loaded. I loved it. And it just led me into, it brought me out from the East Coast to the West Coast. I was a cannabis farmer for 17 years. I met incredible people. I made a fortune. And then that fortune, it turned into an absolute nightmare.
And, how so?
The same thing that Lucas is talking about. Like, what really, I didn't have a relationship with myself anymore, with my soul, with my spirit. I didn't have a true, clean, clear relationship with my family, with my community. It was all based around getting loaded and escaping. So what I want to say that I have this disease of addiction. It's an obsession of my mind, and it's a allergy of my body where I can intake massive amounts of drugs and alcohol. Like, it, you know, that would kill an elephant. You know, I can handle that on a daily basis. And having that condition and having the condition of, like, I need more and more and more of drugs and alcohol and other things too, money, you know, all the stuff that comes with addiction. And none of it ever felt like enough, ever.
So there's, it sounds like there's an empty place that can't be filled.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good metaphor that's used a lot, yeah.
So then, what happened?
Great question. Want to go first?
So there was a several instances of reoccurring stuff like the story that I just told. And mm-hmm. The biggest one for me was one day when I came home and the girl that I'm currently with now told me that she couldn't be with me anymore because she was done watching me kill myself. And it was that all over again. That, you know, house was for sale and I couldn't stop drinking. I kind of got a little hold on the drugs because that was a Portland Lucas. Mm-hmm. I call it Portland Lucas. Portland Lucas is dead. But Seattle Lucas likes to drink, and she doesn't like drinking Seattle Lucas. So what happened was many, many times trying on my own to quit, I couldn't. 4 days, 30 days, and it always, my mind personally much tricks me, thinking, well, it's fine. You deserve a beer after work with the guys, which absolutely is a mirage. There's no such thing as a beer after work with the guys, because it's next thing you know, it's 4 a.m, or I'm on a train, or, you know, it's just nuts.
Wow.
And I met this guy. I said, okay, I was actually trying to prove to her that I was going to clean my act up, and I Googled an AA meeting and I met some guys, and long story short, I ended up, did I just say that?
No.
Yeah. I found some guys that had the similar problems and they cared about me. They seemed genuine and I trusted them, reluctantly trusted them, and just kept showing up. So, and now they're my best friends. I don't have any other friends, really, you know?
Yeah, I want to talk more about that connection after I hear what happened to Toph. So what happened to you? Yeah.
My own personal experience is I could not for the life of me stop using drugs and alcohol. No matter what I tried personally, did not work. I could not stay stopped no matter what I tried.
For the life of me,
for
which
the
is
life
pretty literal,
of me.
Yeah.
So my family... I dragged my family through this for years. It's heartbreaking, this stuff. And I got to that place in my progression of my disease where I could not take it anymore. I couldn't take it. I felt like I had tried everything. I danced around 12-step recovery a little bit for a couple of years and thought everybody in there was totally, that they weren't my tribe of people, and that I felt better than them. And it wasn't until I went to the absolute bottom of my own progression with this stuff that my family had their second intervention for me. And they went around the circle, and I was basically crazy. At that time, I was really sick. I was mean. I'd been up for days. And they went around the circle, the people I loved most, and I don't remember what they said, each of them, but tears were pouring down their eyes, and they all said things to me like, we think you're going to die any second, we don't know what to say anymore, but the thing I truly remember each of them saying is, I love you, and they all went around the circle and said that. And then when my son, he was 13 at the time, he looked in my eyes and he said, Dad, I just want you to be okay. Mm. So I got in the car, and they drove me up to treatment, and I stayed there from June 21st, which is my sobriety date, till September 21st. So every day of summer that year, I spent in a treatment center, and I started to listen like I was dying, like the dying do. I started to listen to my drug counselor and the other people there at treatment.
So you were able to allow that in.
I was broken enough to entertain the idea of... listening to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And you, dear listener, are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and we are talking with Toph and Lucas about addiction and recovery therefrom. We can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They make all our information programming and our emergency alert service possible. So we've talked about what it was like, what happened to bring you to what I'm going to call bottom. bottoming out?
Yeah.
What's it like now?
It's tough.
Lucas, yeah.
Yeah.
Good call.
No kidding.
So, yeah, it's a long road. So I've been sober for 3 years now, and it's still at the forefront of my thoughts, you know, and sometimes, yeah, I'm stumbling over myself with my pride and my ego and my selfishness. And those are all things that after the smoke has cleared from the drugs and alcohol, now you're just left with who you are. And it's tough to deal with and try to just, one of the things that we like to say is, we just try to do the next right thing, regardless of the outcome or how you feel, without being attached to the outcome, you know?
That sounds very Buddhist. The whole idea of overcoming ego and getting ego out of the way, is that part of the 12-step program?
It can be. I think, yeah, pretty. It is. Yeah, I mean, so me personally, I don't really enjoy the process. I don't. It's work. It's homework. It's being uncomfortable. It's looking at yourself in the mirror and not liking what you see, and it's all that ugliness surfaces, and you have to deal with it. Otherwise, well, and I tend to believe the guys that have come before me that have a lot of sobriety, that stuff will get you drunk again. That stuff will get you high again. You got to deal with this stuff. And part of that in this 12-step program that I attend deals with all that kind of stuff. And it's broken down into steps. And it's not enjoyment. It's not like something I enjoy. It's something I do because it's encouraged. And I've seen it work for other people. So I try to dive in wholeheartedly without being, you know, lazy, because I'm a lazy person. You know?
Would you put it in the category of brushing your teeth and working out regularly?
Yeah, I mean, you can, I would absolutely go, you can, you know, go to the gym and just hang out, but you're not going to probably get in shape. You have to, so it's kind of, but showing up, absolutely. If you show up, eventually you might just start picking up a dumbbell, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I showed up just reluctantly because they said so for probably, well, I'm still doing it. I just show up, you know, that's the biggest part.
And do you feel as though you will be doing this for the rest of your life in order to maintain?
I'd like to. Yeah. I wouldn't mind it. Yeah. And supposedly it gets easier, you know?
Hmm.
Toph, what about you?
Same here. I do what I don't want to do in recovery. I don't want to go to meetings. I don't want to call my sponsor. I don't want to pray or meditate. And that is the exact stuff that brings me peace in my mind, in my spirit, in my relationships. But I don't want to do that. You know, I do what I don't want to do. And I want to say now that, like, after doing this for a little while, that I never knew what it was like to feel comfortable in my own skin without drugs and alcohol. Never, even as a kid, before I even did drugs and alcohol. And now going through the 12-step process and having an incredible recovery crew in my life, and a sponsor, and working these steps and taking others through them, I feel genuine peace in my life during certain moments. There's like the channel is opening in my life to something greater than myself. My relationships are real and they're true and they're full of intimacy and real connection.
You know, I hear you say, for the first time, I feel comfortable in my skin without drugs and alcohol. I get a similar impression from you, Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
And what that says to me, it makes me wonder, what is it about our culture that says to you two fine men, you're not okay?
Is she talking to us?
Yeah. What is it about our culture? And I'm guessing you guys have thought about this and explored it, because we know addiction is rampant in our culture, especially among men, but men and women.
Right.
What is it? What is our culture doing to us, or not giving to us, that requires the escape or the comfort of substance abuse?
The need to fit in, the need to feel equal among your fellows, and if that's somehow not a feeling, a natural feeling, like when you're a kid, once drugs and alcohol, for me anyway, once that was introduced, I felt equal, if not more, you know, I felt, so I don't know about society of how like you're supposed to look and materialistic things is the measure of a man. It's just, when is it okay to just be you, you know what I mean? So if you, I guess if, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but a low self-esteem or a huge ego would direct somebody into addiction, I guess, you know?
Well, it seems like those are kind of opposite ends of the same pole.
We have
low self-esteem
going on at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Which is,
right.
I guess someone might call that crazy.
I'm not sure it's crazy. My fear is that that narrow path that our culture allows, particularly for men,
yes,
to be acceptable, is crazy making.
Absolutely.
What about you, Toph?
I want to say there's the Nietzsche quote, "It is no measure of health to be profoundly adjusted to a sick society."
Ah.
And that is the story of my life, and I think all of our lives here in modern America. I mean, I don't want to get into that too much because we could talk about that forever.
Well,
but I will say that, like, you know, addiction is a family disease, and it's also a disease that's in our communities all over America, mm-hmm, all over the world. The mm-hmm opiate epidemic and alcoholism has ravaged families and communities for so long now. And what Lucas said, like that feeling of belonging, that feeling of welcome and being included and inclusivity, and having this genuine way to transform through the 12 steps that we've found that has worked for, nothing else has ever worked for me. I could not buy that. I could not run away into that solution. I had to just be with other people and do the work that were living on that same simple, real level.
You talked about your recovery crew.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Who is your recovery crew? How do your lives intersect with theirs?
For me, it was finding some people I could tolerate and that I believed. I'm not trying to make a bunch of like friends or anything, or I guess, but at the same time, that's all I'm trying to do. It's kind of strange. I don't know how about getting into specifics about, they're just like-minded people that have shared some of our similar experiences that are actually actively trying to do better.
And these are men that you found in your meetings?
Yes.
In your 12-step recovery meetings?
Yeah. My one friend says something really good about this. He says, if you want to have a really good recovery crew, you have to be willing to be awkward in the beginning, because we're all used to drinking and getting loaded for years with our friends. That being vulnerable and feeling not a part of, and then connecting with other people, is totally out of our comfort zone. But if we really want to recover and we really want true friendship in our life, we have to be just willing to show up and do that. And the men that are in my home group and that are in my inner circle, they taught me how to do that. I didn't know how to do that without drugs and alcohol and making money.
So define that. What is that? Is it vulnerability? Is it intimacy?
All those things. And it's love. I mean, there's no ulterior motive. It's about healing and love and connection and soul.
What would you say to people who are, I mean, for so many of us in this culture, particularly in 20s, 30s, 40s, after you're out of school and you're in you're trying to make something of yourself, as they say, I put that in quotes, as if you started out with nothing or as nothing. What would you say to people about how to develop close friends? Because if you're meeting them at work, there's a barrier. You can't show what might be considered weakness, which is actually human vulnerability. Or if you meet men, for instance, on the sports field, mm-hmm, not a lot of intimacy there.
Yeah, but there's an objective. There's a like at work, there's a project, and you can bond by working with someone, because you start from the ground up, and then you have this accomplishment to see. And I always think to myself, when they started this program a long time ago, that the whole idea was to get a bunch of these alcoholics and drug addicts together and give them an unsolvable puzzle to solve, and it'll just keep them at it for years. You know what I mean? Because some of this stuff makes absolutely no sense, but we keep trying to figure it out. And some people think they've got a really good grasp on it. And other people like myself, I guess you could say I'm just still showing up, and I believe these guys, I love these guys, and they're safe. I'm safe around them. They want what's best for me. I want what's best for them. And 60 days turns into 9 months, turns into a year. And I've always said that 30 days clean and sober is a lot harder than 3 years. The first 30, 60, mm-hmm. it's almost impossible. So the young or the new guys that are struggling at 15 days, that's the worst part of it. Like 3 years just kind of happened. It seems strange.
How do you find what you have learned in the 12-step program affecting your outside relationships? Because you said you can go to work and bond over a project. Are you more open to intimacy with your friends that you might meet at work or in other situations?
Definitely, 100%. And I just want to say that the work that I'm in, since I'm in the field of addiction recovery,
yeah.
My boss, who's the coolest boss in the world, she encourages me to be as weird as I want to be. Be my true self. Be weird. She told me that when she hired me, and I quoted her on it. I said, I'm quoting you on this. I'm writing down the date. She said, I'll reel you in if you get too weird, and it hasn't happened. So like those of us in this community, we get to be ourselves. We get to be whole human beings, dark and light. And how that translates into my personal relationships is profound.
Those that are outside your recovery crew or
absolutely.
The meetings.
And as a father, mm-hmm. How I am with my children, how I raise them, how I can talk with them about the real stuff. And when I get too full of pride, this 12-step program has taught me a way to humble myself and tell them that I don't actually really know what I'm doing, but I love you like no tomorrow. And I'm going to keep loving you no matter what, no matter what I think I know.
You know, you make it sound like we should all be doing a 12-step program. I think the entire country should be in recovery.
Yeah.
It worked lucky. For us. Yeah. It worked
yeah.
for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are the lucky ones.
Well, as I predicted, we're running out of time. And I know, Toph, you had a poem you'd like to read for us. Tell us who the poet is and what you want.
Thank you. So I wanted to end it on this poem. It's from John O'Donohue from his book, To Bless the Space Between Us. It's a poem called For an Addict. And I think it sums up a lot of stuff here. And the purpose of reading a soul poem at the end is really to connect to the divine. So I think it's a great way to end this. Okay, so.
And quickly, because a lot of folks avoid the 12-step program because they might not be Christian. When you say the divine, can
yes.
you give us a quick non-Christian definition of that?
Just keep an open mind. We're not the end all be all. There's the only thing you need is an open mind.
Great.
Yep.
All right, John O'Donohue.
For an Addict. On its way through the innocent night, the moth is ambushed by the light, becomes glued to a window where a candle burns its whole self, its dreams of flight and all desire trapped in one glazed gaze. Now nothing else can satisfy but the deadly beauty of flame. When you lose the feel for all other belonging, and what is truly near becomes distant and ghostly, and you are visited and claimed by a simplicity sinister in its singularity. No longer yourself, your mind and will owned and steered from somewhere else now. You would sacrifice anything to dance once more to the haunted music with your fatal beloved who owns the eyes of your heart. These words of blessing cannot reach even as echoes to the shore of where you are. Yet may they work without you to soften some slight line to the white cave where your soul is captive. May some glimmer of outside light reach your eyes to help you recognize you have fallen for a vampire. May you crash hard and soon onto real ground again, where this fundamentalist shell might start to crack for you to hear again your own echo. That your lost, lonesome heart might learn to cry out for the true intimacy of love that waits to take you home, to where you are known and seen, and where your life is treasured beyond every frontier of despair you have ever crossed.
Thank you, Toph. Thank you, John O'Donohue. And thank you, Lucas, for joining us in our discussion of addiction and recovery. And for those of you who have fallen for the vampire of addiction, there's hope. You've been listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to hear on the Voice of Vashon next.